Still, I did not come here today to elicit sympathy, and I can't help feeling guilty about the publicity that this trial has gathered, when the most vulnerable members of our society, the women, the children, the elderly, are seemingly assaulted, murdered and abused on a daily basis.
It was a quiet night in Stellenbosch, a town located in the Western Cape of South Africa, on the 27th of May 2017. University student Hannah Cornelius had offered her friend, Cheslin Marsh, a lift back home after a night out. As they sat chatting in her parked car outside his apartment, they were unaware that they were being watched. Hannah Cornelius was born in Scarborough, a charming seaside town nestled within the city of Cape Town in South Africa, on the 12th of February 1996. Her father, William Cornelius, held the esteemed position of chief magistrate in Simonstown, while her mother Anna had carved a notable reputation as a legal expert specialising in criminal and family law within Cape legal circles. Anna did a lot of pro bono work for the underprivileged. Although born prematurely, at a mere 1.8 kilograms, Hannah thrived under the nurturing affection of her devoted parents. Drawn by the town's scenic allure, the family chose to make Scarborough their home, enveloped by woodland and facing the sea. With demanding professions, William and Anna sought respite in Scarborough's tranquility at the end of their grueling work days. 2 years following Hannah's birth, Andries joined the family. And at the tender age of 2, he was diagnosed with autism. Anna had exceptional patience and affection for her younger brother, traits that her cousin, Lani, attested to. She stated, "She never hesitated to say that he was her brother. There wasn't a moment that she wasn't proud of him or loved him. Her biggest concern was always whether he was going to be okay." Festive seasons and vacations often saw the family's retreat to Die Verd, an area not too far from Stellenbosch and the university that was located there. Occasional travels to Mozambique became cherished family traditions, involving an extensive gathering of grandparents, cousins, aunts and uncles. Hannah's first trip to India impacted her life and made her think twice about the world. She was heartbroken to see so much poverty, and when she came back home, she vowed to never have another birthday party again. Her father recollected.
Her 16th birthday fell shortly after a backpacking trip to India with her mother. And when we asked her what she would like to have for a birthday party or a birthday present, she informed us that she could not in good conscience spend money on herself while people around her were living in poverty. She made and we accepted a proposal to rather make up gift bags for the children in a nearby informal settlement. And she duly accompanied Mr. Kwekwe, our gardener, to Radio, where she displayed her party packs. This was also how she celebrated her subsequent birthdays at home.
Hannah's educational journey led her to the English private school named Radham House, where her remarkable talent, particularly in piano, flourished, achieving 6 distinctions upon matriculation, with an average exceeding 85%. Hannah's impact was exemplified by her high school principal, David Clark, who recalled, "She just made the world a better place. She was one of those outstanding kids." Fluency in French further accentuated Hannah's skills. Following her 2015 matriculation, she embarked on a year-long stint as an au pair in France. By 2017, Hannah was a 21-year-old in her second year of humanities studies at the University of Stellenbosch. She moved away from the family home and into Irene Residence. This female dormitory on the university campus hosted 321 students, and it was strategically located near Stellenbosch's scenic charm, right at the end of Victoria Street. Overlooking the J.S. Marais Park, a serene nature reserve, it offered an ideal setting for leisurely afternoon walks and rejuvenating study breaks. Beyond the reserve, the stunning Stellenbosch Mountain surrounded the area, and Hannah was proud to call Irene Residence her home. At university, she was recognised for her kind and compassionate demeanour, Her friends all described her as a sweet soul, with Rihanna Engelbrecht saying of her, "She was a flower. When she walked into her room, she brightened it up completely. She stood out, whether it was because she was wearing an interesting skirt or red shoes." According to her cousin Lolly, Hannah's impact was far-reaching, touching everyone with her inner and outer beauty. Lolly affectionately regarded Hannah as the family's paragon of perfection. A person who, despite her own challenges, never ceased to inquire about others' well-being. During her free time, Hannah found solace in writing, fueled by aspirations of forging a career in the field, possibly even journalism. She had a penchant for writing poems and a deep love for animals, which led her to dedicate her time as a constant volunteer at the Emma Animal Rescue Society. On the evening of May 26, 2017, Hannah was in the company of her friend Cheslin Marsh. They visited a local bar before spending time at a university dormitory with some acquaintances. As the early morning hours approached, Cheslin accompanied Hannah back to Irene's residence. However, when he mentioned his intention to walk back home alone afterwards, Hannah kindly offered him a ride. Agreeing to the offer, Cheslin and Hannah both entered Hannah's Blue City Golf car, a vehicle given to her by her grandmother. The time was around 3:23 a.m. when they arrived at Cheslin's apartment complex on Birdstraat, which was situated less than 2 kilometres away from Hannah's residence at Irene Residence. Engaging in conversation, they remained parked in the car, unaware that they were under observation. Unbeknownst to them, a group of 4 men dressed in dark clothing with hoods raised were walking towards their location down the road. One of the men momentarily stepped into the road to peer inside the car, then rejoined the others before passing the vehicle and disappearing around the corner. Seemingly innocently chatting, Hannah and Cheslin remained oblivious to the fact that these men were exchanging words and plotting something sinister. In a span of less than 2 minutes, the 4 men returned and approached the car from behind. As Cheslin prepared to bid Hannah farewell and opened the passenger side door, one of the men stealthily crept up and seized him by the shoulder. Upon turning around, Cheslin encountered the glint of a knife gripped in the man's hand, a disturbing sight that marked the beginning of a tragic turn of events. Subsequently, the unfamiliar man directed Cheslin to re-enter the car. He warned, "Sit still or you'll die," all while holding the knife against Cheslin's back. Another member of the group circled the car, zoning in on the driver's seat, where Hannah sat bewildered. He reached his hand through an open window and held a screwdriver to Hannah's neck. Fear gripped Hannah as she asked the men what they wanted. One of the men responded, claiming they merely sought transportation home and promised to return the car. He warned that if they made a noise, they would both be killed. Cheslin's cell phone, jacket, R40 in cash, a windsurfing board, and Caterpillar boots were among the items confiscated. They took his bank card and money, although his wallet was given back to him. Hannah's purse and mobile phone were also taken. With these items, one of the 4 men took off on foot, but the ordeal was far from over. The 3 remaining men then forcibly ushered Cheslin into the car's trunk and instructed Hannah to position herself between the front seats. Seizing control of the vehicle, they distributed themselves within, one in the driver's seat, and the remaining 2 settling into the back. The driver wielded a knife while the other 2 rear passengers held screwdrivers. During the following span of time, the 3 men navigated the streets with their captives, searching for a drug dealer. They additionally made an unsuccessful attempt to withdraw money from an ATM using Cheslin's bank card, but his provided PIN was incorrect. Their journey continued, culminating in the desolate expanse of a gravel path adjacent to a farm in Craffontein. In this concealed location, shrouded by foliage and stones, the men compelled Cheslin to emerge from the trunk. They ordered him to lie prone on the ground, instructing him to position his head on a brick. With chilling brutality, 2 of the men seized bricks and proceeded to hurl them at Cheslin's head and face. Amid the brutal attack, Cheslin suffered multiple stab wounds, the culmination of which was followed by the swift departure of the three men with Hannah still confined in the car. The assault had left Cheslin in a near-fatal state, his injuries extensive and severe. His arm had been fractured and his head and face was badly bruised and swollen. Miraculously, however, Cheslin wasn't dead. Despite the harrowing ordeal, Cheslin's survival was nothing short of miraculous. Though rendered unconscious, he eventually regained consciousness, immersed in a haze of pain and bewilderment. Summoning his resolve, he managed to lift himself from the ground, a process that demanded several agonizing minutes as he grappled with the disorientation brought on by the attack's aftermath. In the shrouded darkness, he was unsure of his exact location, and unsure where Hannah was. Guided by instincts, Cheslin stumbled along the road until he chanced upon the faint glow of the first house in his field of vision. Navigating past a wall, he entered the backyard and urgently pounded on the back door. His frantic actions were met with an unexpected obstacle, an unleashed dog that promptly gave chase, clamping its jaws onto Cheslin's pants. Despite the bark and growls, Cheslin was resolute in seeking help. Inside the home, Avril 14 and his wife Margaret responded to the clamour by opening up their window. The sight that met their eyes was a chilling one. A blood-soaked stranger stood before them, barefoot and dishevelled from head to toe. In the seconds that followed, Avril's initial assumption was that Cheslin had been embroiled in a fight in the adjacent field. Completely bewildered and disoriented, Cheslin was in dire need of assistance. Despite his shaky demeanour, he said that somebody was trying to kill him, and he begged to call his mother. Evidently propelled by the surge of adrenaline coursing through him, Cheslin was resolute in his determination to survive the ordeal, and he begged the couple for help. Concurrently, serendipity was at play, as a police vehicle happened to be passing by. Avril promptly flagged down the officers, recounting the event and drawing their attention to the young man who had sought refuge at their doorstep only moments ago. After the three men left Cheslin behind, they transported a terrified Hannah to a secluded wooded area located behind Reaper's Paintball on Baudelaire Road. She remained oblivious to Cheslin's fate, uncertain if he had survived or if he was lying dead somewhere. In the darkness of the wooded area, Hannah was forcibly pulled from the car and subjected to a series of sexual assaults, with each man taking their turn. Subsequently, they drove Hannah to Stellenbosch, then to the desolate Greenhoff farm. There, they guided her down an isolated path running alongside the vineyards. It was in this eerie setting that Hannah endured further brutality. She was stabbed twice in the neck with a screwdriver before a heavy rock was dropped onto her head. As she lay on the ground, her life slipping away, the three men continued to assault her. Meanwhile, at Avril and Margaret's home, the police spoke with Cheslin and swiftly rushed him to the hospital. His injuries were extensive, including a skull fracture that had resulted in the leakage of brain fluid. He had sustained three separate head wounds on his left ear, forehead, and the back of his head. His forearm was fractured, and his eardrum had been ruptured. At around 9 a.m. that same morning, Conrad Boyson, a technician, was on his way to his workplace in Norhook Road, near a wine farm. As he approached the site, he noticed a disarray, particularly regarding the large rock he had placed over a borehole the previous night. It was conspicuously missing. As he and his colleague began the task of cleaning up, an object in the vicinity captured their attention. Conrad would later describe how, from a distance, he initially mistook it for a discarded doll or perhaps a white bag. However, as he drew closer and the object became more discernible, a grim realization set in. It was the lifeless body of a young woman. Tragically, Hannah lay there with blood seeping from her mouth and eyes, her underwear partially pulled down her legs. Nearby, the large rock had been relocated from its position the night before. The discovery was devastating, as it was unmistakably Hannah, and her condition was far beyond any hope of revival. The medical examiner's office, a thorough examination revealed the extent of her injuries. Hannah had suffered a severe head injury from a blunt object, resulting in multiple fractures to her skull. Additionally, two stab wounds were identified on her neck, with the pathologist concluding that one of these stab wounds, combined with the fatal head injuries, had led to her untimely death. The pathologist's findings indicated that Hannah had been struck on the right side of her skull while being forcibly held down, resulting in a rapid death. Furthermore, evidence of severe genital injuries, including cervical trauma, was uncovered during the examination. Shortly after 2 p.m, detectives located Hannah's car on a farm in Devon Valley in Stellenbosch. Upon their approach, the vehicle abruptly accelerated, initiating a high-speed pursuit reaching speeds of 160 kilometers per hour. The chase eventually came to a halt in the vicinity of a farm, where one of the occupants fled on foot, while the passenger was promptly apprehended. The arrested individual was identified as 32-year-old Vernon Whitboy. Simultaneously, another police officer pursued the fleeing suspect and successfully apprehended him, identifying him as 26-year-old Geraldo Parsons. In the days that followed, the remaining two individuals implicated in the heinous crimes of murder and attempted murder were also captured. These individuals were identified as 26-year-old Nashville Julius and 27-year-old Eben Van Niekerk. All four men had been captured on surveillance footage throughout the ordeal that cost Hannah her life. In the aftermath of the tragic murder, the Honourable Deputy Minister of Police extended heartfelt condolences to Hannah's grieving family. Alongside his condolences, he highlighted the commendable speed with which detectives had apprehended the suspects responsible. Fueled by a sense of duty, he also decried the recurring and persistent attacks inflicted upon young women, girls and children within the region. With conviction, he declared, "We will leave no stone unturned to fighting against and defeating the madness and scourge against young women, girls and children." A mere week before the chilling hijacking incident, a dramatic scene unfolded in Brooklyn, where two women found themselves in danger. Confronted by two armed men demanding entry to their car, the women's quick thinking averted disaster. In a split second, they activated the central locking system, and as one of the men prepared to unleash his firearm, a surge of courage propelled the driver's foot to the pedal, propelling them to safety. This was just one of many similar attacks in the area over the preceding months. The brutal murder sent shockwaves ripping through the area, casting a shadow of sorrow and disbelief. Nowhere were these reverberations more palpable than within the confines of the university where Hannah and Cheslin had been students. Luke Waltham, an impassioned activist and fellow student, lent voice to the collective sentiment of horror, disgust and disbelief shared by the student body. He stated, "We, as students of Stellenbosch University and residents of this community, are horrified, disgusted and appalled." He shone a spotlight on a prevailing concern that was now impossible to ignore, the glaring inadequacies in security both within the university and throughout the town. The mayor of Stellenbosch, Hazy van Deventer, weighed in, revealing a bureaucratic obstacle faced by the municipality. She explained that while Stellenbosch desired greater security measures, the municipality was restricted to maintaining a law enforcement division, with authority limited to overseeing municipal bylaws, an unfortunate predicament in the face of growing security challenges. The arrest of Hannah's killers provided little solace to the women within the community, who remained haunted by the spectre of violence. This pervasive unease triggered a response that demonstrated their resilience and determination to protect themselves. In a bid to counter this collective fear, more than 3,000 women affiliated with the university banded together, forming an emergency WhatsApp group. This digital sanctuary served as a lifeline, a virtual haven where women could connect and seek help should they find themselves in a dangerous situation. The murder of Hannah had only been one in a recent spate of attacks on women, including muggings in the university area. Many women felt as though the security provided by the university was not up to standard. They needed to seek steps to protect themselves. In fact, just the night after Hannah was killed, a woman was hijacked by two men who smashed her windows and kidnapped her. They stole her handbag and laptop, but eventually they dropped her off near an isolated farm. 2 days before Hannah was killed, a man was hijacked when he stopped to give a lift to two men. One of these men attempted to strangle him and shocked him with a taser gun before making off with his vehicle. The media reported that the murder of women in South Africa was in an upward trajectory, and in the same week that Hannah was killed, five other women were killed. In the wake of the murders, Hannah's family provided a poignant statement, highlighting the impact of their loss. Her uncle Dree said that the entire family was devastated and that they had to identify her body. He said that the murder just made no sense, adding, "What is the reason behind killing her if you already have the car?" He said that to him it looked as though the men went out that night with the plan to kill. Hannah's little brother Andries reportedly couldn't comprehend that his sister was never coming home and repeatedly kept asking about her. Meanwhile, Cheslin was still being tended to in the hospital. He had sustained damage to his hearing from the bricks being thrown at his head, but above all else, he was emotionally scarred by what had happened. His mother Marilyn said that he blamed himself for not being able to save Hannah's life, although there was nothing he could have done. He was brutally attacked by the three men as well, and it was miraculous that he had managed to escape with his life. Marilyn commented that Cheslin always had a lot of manpower, but was broken that he couldn't have done more for Hannah. She said that she thanked God every single day that her son survived, and was grateful that despite his pain and trauma, he had been able to give detectives information about his attackers. Following the arrest, it came to light that three of the suspects involved in the brutal murder were affiliated with various gangs. Whitboy and Parsons were associated with the notorious 28 gangs, while Van Niekerk was a member of the 26 gang. Both of these factions are part of the Numbers Gang, a network of prison gangs in South Africa, renowned for their intricate hierarchical structures, distinctive rituals, and criminal activities. These gangs are divided into different groups, each bearing its own unique number. The 28th gang is frequently linked with representing the interests of other gangs, and is characterized by a rigorous ranking system, where members must prove their masculinity by engaging in acts such as stabbing or killing rival gangs, prison guards, or dissenting members. In contrast, the 26's gang specializes in crimes related to robbery, smuggling, and financial gains. Members often serve as prison cleaners and are generally considered less violent than the 28's. On the night of Hannah's murder, Parsons, Whitboy, and Van Niekerk were initially in Stellenbosch searching for drugs. During their venture, they encountered Julius, and together they began roaming the streets. Their paths crossed with Hannah and Cheslin, who were seated in her blue Golf. Parsons proposed to the others that they should steal the car and confine its occupants in the trunk. After robbing Hannah and Cheslin, Julius separated from the group and returned home on his own. Following the murder and attempted murder, Parsons, Whitboy, and Van Niekerk continued their criminal activities. In the morning, they robbed a woman near the Kryfontein station, taking her handbag and mobile phone. Later, around 1 p.m, they targeted another woman, Minnie October, near a shopping centre. They compelled her into Hannah's car, positioning her between two men in the back seat. The men stole her bank card, wedding rings, and two cell phones. Parsons was driving while Whitboy attempted to withdraw money using her bank card after she shared her PIN number out of fear. They eventually dropped her off at a four-way intersection before heading back towards Stellenbosch. During the journey, Van Niekerk expressed his desire to return home due to tiredness. Consequently, Whitboy and Parsons provided him with some money before continuing towards Delft to sell Hannah's car. However, they noticed that they were being followed by police. In an effort to evade capture, Parsons halted the car and fled, ultimately leading to their arrests. For enthusiasts of classic mysteries packed with twists, June's Journey is the ultimate gaming delight. embark on an adventure with the endearing amateur sleuth June Parker, uncovering the truth behind her sister's death and unearthing some long-held family secrets. With over 1,000 meticulously crafted scenes, hone your observational skills as you hunt for concealed clues and crucial information. Immerse yourself in the glamorous 1920s through the captivating visuals and engaging gameplay of June's journey. I've been playing this mobile puzzle game for well over 2 years now, and I often find myself playing late at night as a way to unwind before bed. Among its highlights, June's Journey lets you craft your own island estate and become part of a detective club. Download June's Journey for free on iOS and Android. At the time of their apprehension, Whip-Boy already had an outstanding arrest warrant due to his failure to appear in court for an unrelated case on March 14th. Whip-Boy claimed that he had been abducted on his way to court and held until April, raising further concerns about the police's ability to protect citizens. On the 30th of May, Whip-Boy and Parsons were formally charged with murder, kidnapping and robbery, with aggravating circumstances. They also faced attempted murder charges related to the attack on Cheslin. The courtroom was filled to the brim with Hannah's loved ones and university students, with some even sitting on the floor and standing on the sidelines due to the lack of seating. Those unable to enter the courtroom gathered outside, holding signs condemning violence against women. Both Whip-Boy and Parsons expressed their intention to seek legal aid and opted to forgo bail. The following day, Julius appeared in court where he faced charges of kidnapping and aggravated robbery. His charges differed because surveillance footage indicated his departure from the scene before the car sped off with Hannah and Cheslin trapped inside. On the 1st of June, hundreds of people gathered at Irene residence to commemorate Hannah. The memorial service commenced by distributing black and white ribbons to each student and staff member, a symbolic representation of the complex emotions born since Hannah's tragic death. The white ribbon embodied peace, humility, purity, innocence, and youth, while the black ribbon symbolized unhappiness, sadness, and remorse. Condolence messages penned by Hannah's friends were read aloud, a poignant reflection of their affection for her. In the aftermath of the service, seeds were sown in the garden adjacent to the dining hall, a living tribute to Hannah's memory. Rihanna, the resident principal, captured Hannah's essence with the words, "She was a real flower child. She made the same impression on you as a flower in a house. She was sunny, warm, and endearing." The blossoms would unfurl in September, a poignant reminder that Hannah's spirit would forever remain intertwined with her loved ones. The following day, a procession took place at Bird Street, the site where Hannah and Cheslin were taken. Concurrently, Eben van Niekerk appeared before the court, facing charges of murder, kidnapping, and robbery with aggravated circumstances. On June 3rd, an assembly of around 3,000 individuals filled NH Church for Hannah's funeral, which was presided over by Reverend Jan van Heerden. Amidst the somber gathering, he encouraged mourners not to succumb to anger over the tragic events, but rather to celebrate the vibrant life that Hannah had led. Numerous friends of Hannah stepped forward to pay their tributes, with Jacqueline Catterson expressing that Hannah was now an angel borrowed by heaven, free from pain. Notably absent from the ceremony was Cheslin, who was still in the process of recuperating in the hospital. While he was physically absent, his mother Marilyn was present, conveying his deep regret for being unable to bid his friend a final farewell in person. During the service, the notes of Hannah's lullaby, a song composed by Hannah's grandfather, filled the airwaves. He had composed the song back when Hannah was just a baby. Upon the service's conclusion, a procession of over 300 motorcyclists rode past the church. It was a fitting tribute as both of Hannah's parents, William and Anna, shared a passion for motorcycles. In this emotional moment, William offered a peace sign to his fellow motorcyclists. At the hospital, Cheslin underwent a surgery to mend his broken arm, while the damage to his eardrums from the hurled bricks persisted. His release finally came on the 9th of June. Upon leaving the hospital, he embarked on a journey of psychological counselling to address the trauma he had endured. Initially, he expressed reluctance to return to Stellenbosch University. However, after consulting with a psychologist, he contemplated resuming his studies, though he remained undecided. His mother shared with the media that some days Cheslin barely spoke at all, while on others words poured out. She hoped for his hearing to recover with ongoing treatment. Yet if that outcome proved elusive, she acknowledged the potential need to raise funds for a hearing aid, bearing in mind the considerable medical expenses they had already incurred. On July 29th, Whitboy, Parsons, Julius and Van Niekerk appeared in court collectively. Cheslin, who was accompanied by his mother, attended to witness the individuals responsible for his friend's death and his own ordeal. As the men were brought before the court, Cheslin's heart raced, the memory of that fateful night vividly returning. Proceedings were subsequently adjourned for further investigation. Come September, Hannah's parents revealed an establishment of a trust in her honour. The trust aimed to channel positivity towards the numerous parents and children who, like them, had undergone similar tragedies. Anna commented in the media, "It is a mourning and a difficult time. We are not willing to look at just the negative stuff. It's over now." She said that Hannah was just one of thousands of people who had been killed in South Africa, and that she wanted something positive to come out of her brutal murder. She stated, "We want to create a new vision for the youth of the future, even if it takes us 2 to 3 generations. We want to create a new vision and future for children who otherwise did not have a future. The problems in our country can't go on the way it's going." Shortly thereafter, William and Anna did an interview from their home. They said that immediately after Hannah's murder, they travelled around Chile just to get away from the memories of what had happened. Throughout the interview, Hannah's brother Andres kept coming into the room, and he asked several times when Hannah was coming home. They spoke about the foundation they had set up, with Anna commenting, "I may live a very long time, and there must be a vision. How do you overcome this incredible pain? You never get over it. Never, never, never. But you make it part of you. The only way I can channel and process the pain is by helping other people." The Hannah Cornelius Foundation was launched on the 30th of October. It aimed to offer support, guidance and mentoring to the youth, especially those at risk, and help young people fulfill their potential. Towards the end of November, Whitboy, Parsons, Julius and Van Niekerk appeared in court once more. During the court proceeding, Parsons smiled and blew kisses to his girlfriend. She spoke with the media afterwards and referred to him as her man. She also said they had an 8-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old son together. As the van left the courtroom carrying the 4 suspects, she shouted out, "I love you, Geraldo." It was a scene that left many in the courtroom bewildered. Her boyfriend stood accusing of raping and brutally murdering a young girl, and yet she stood by his side. In March the following year, the case against the 4 men was transferred to the High Court of Cape Town. The murder trial was scheduled for the following month after being postponed several times. Before then, on the 25th of March, Hannah's family was hit with another tragedy when her mother, Anna, drowned. She was discovered floating offshore in Scarborough. She had gotten into difficulty during her usual morning swim at around 7 a.m. She had been sick with the flu and had just finished her series of antibiotics the night before. Lily Reid, the CEO of the Hannah Cornelius Foundation, stated, "I think it might have been too soon. Her body just wasn't healthy enough yet. The sea is very cold. Lifeguards say she fainted in the water." She dispelled any theories that Anna was suicidal over her daughter's death and said that it was just a tragedy. Friends and relatives said that they found comfort in knowing that Anna had been reunited with her daughter during her funeral service just days later. While Anna was distraught over what had happened to her daughter, she didn't die with hate in her heart. Her loved one said that just a few weeks before she died, she had forgiven her daughter's killers. The murder trial was pushed back further, as Van Niekerk swapped out his defence attorney for a new one. He also attempted to get a plea bargain, but was unsuccessful. The trial was pushed back once more for a judge to be assigned to the case. while the four suspects were behind bars awaiting trial, Parsons managed to get a cell phone in jail. He updated his Facebook profile to a recent photograph that was snapped of him in court. Ironically, he posted a photograph on the 8th of August, the day before Women's Day. It was of a man trying to hit a woman along with the message, "A man who hits a woman is not a man." The long-awaited murder trial commenced on October 8, 2018, with all four men standing trial together. Prosecutor Lenro Badenhorst assumed the role of the prosecutor, while each defendant was represented by their own defense attorneys provided by the Legal Aid Board. As the trial got underway, Whip Boy Parsons, Julius and Van Niekerk entered their pleas, with most entering pleas of not guilty. Notably, Whip Boy, in a striking departure from his co-defendants, pleaded guilty to the kidnapping charges. In a somber admission, he confessed his involvement in the abduction of Hannah and Cheslin, and he did not shy away from revealing his participation in the later kidnapping of Minnie October. His voice resonated through the courtroom as he acknowledged, "I was there and I did rob them." However, Whip Boy went on to offer a different perspective of his actions that fateful night. He claimed that although he did not physically force Cheslin into the car's trunk, he was aware that Cheslin was there against his will. His recollection continued as he said, "I was under the influence of drugs and alcohol. I took the deceased's cell phone, wallet, and bank card." Whitboy's narrative then took a chilling turn as he recounted the events that unfolded after the attack on Cheslin. He claimed that Parsons had returned to the car, expressing the need to dispose of their captive so that they could sell the vehicle. Whitboy detailed how his two co-defendants had taken Hannah to the wooded area behind Reaper's Paintball in Bottlery Road, where she endured unimaginable horror at their hands. He vividly remembered that when they brought Hannah back to the car, she was still dressed in her jacket. The narrative continued as they drove out to the isolated farm. There, Whitboy asserted that his co-defendants, Parsons and Van Niekerk, forcibly led Hannah into the wooded area, ultimately returning without her. Whitboy claimed that on the car ride back, Parsons told him that he had missed out on having sex with Hannah. Despite the detailed nature of Whitboy's plea and explanation, the court chose to reject it, subsequently entering his pleas as not guilty. The murder trial wasted no time in commencing, and the prosecution's star witness, Cheslin Marsh, took to the stand to testify. With unflinching resolve, he began recounting the sequence of events leading up to the horrifying attack. He portrayed Hannah's selflessness, sharing with the courtroom, "She always puts everyone's needs before her own," as the reason she might have offered him a ride back home that fateful night. Tears welled in Cheslin's eyes as he relived the moment where the three men drove him and Hannah to an isolated, desolate area. He choked back his emotions as he recounted Hannah's fear, her trembling voice questioning their intentions. Throughout the ordeal, the defendants had coldly referred to Hannah as the child. Emotions overtook Cheslin and he broke down. His testimony was too overwhelming to continue in that moment. The court adjourned, granting him respite needed to collect himself. The attack that had nearly claimed his life had taken its toll, forcing Cheslin to make profound changes in his life. He had never returned to Stellenbosch University after the event, choosing instead to forge a new path as a waiter. This decision was part of his personal journey to rebuild trust in strangers, a journey that was fraught with challenges. Despite the dedicated efforts of specialists, Cheslin's hearing had never fully recovered. He now faced life deaf in one ear and reliant on hearing aid. Upon his return to the witness stand, Cheslin recounted the assault that had brought him to the brink of death. His voice carried the weight of trauma as he recalled the moment he had lost consciousness, his body racked with pain. With chilling clarity, he remembered, "My whole body was in pain and I couldn't stand. I looked around to see where I am and ran to the first house I saw." In a pivotal moment, Cheslin identified Whitboy and Parsons as the two men who had stood over him with bricks, contradicting Whitboy's earlier claims that he had remained by the car. Photographs depicting the extent of Cheslin's injuries were presented as evidence, serving as a stark reminder of the brutality he had endured. Following Chaslin's brave testimony, Julius made a startling admission through his lawyer. He confessed to being present alongside Parsons, Whipboy, and Van Niekerk during the kidnapping. Julius further admitted to being the one who had stolen Cheslin's cell phone and wallet. Van Niekerk followed suit, acknowledging his involvement in the hijacking, but distancing himself from the rape and murder. He asserted that his participation had been limited to the hijacking and robbering. The courtroom hung in suspense as these admissions reshaped the narrative of the trial. Minnie October, who had experienced the robbery at the hands of the men following Hannah's tragic murder, also took to the stand to share her account. She provided crucial information, pointing out Whipboy, Parsons, and Van Niekerk as the three individuals who had been in the vehicle and were responsible for her kidnapping. She noted that Van Niekerk had remained asleep in the car throughout the entire ordeal. In an unexpected twist, she informed the court that a fourth man, known as Cafferty, was conspicuously absent from the court proceedings. Detectives explained that despite their efforts, they had been unable to locate and apprehend this man, leaving a loose end in the investigation. The unresolved question of his involvement loomed over the trial. Search trends indicate a growing interest in learning new languages, particularly peaking in autumn, a prime time for picking up hobbies. Babbel stands out, promising to have you speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, just in time for the holiday season. Why Babbel, you may ask? Its 10-minute lessons, curated by 150 language experts, provide an effective alternative to costly tutors. As a frequent traveller, Babbel has been invaluable, aiding me in easily booking taxis, ordering food, and conversing with locals. Start your language journey this fall with Babbel. Here's a special, limited-time deal for our listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Morbidology listeners, at babbel.com/morbidology. Get 55% off at babbel.com/morbidology, spelled babbel.com/morbidology. Rules and restrictions may apply. As the trial progressed, however, forensic evidence took center stage. A revelation emerged as Parsons' fingerprint was linked to a condom wrapper discovered at the scene of Hannah's rape and murder. More incriminating, used condoms found at the scene bore DNA that matched both Parsons and Whipboy. Intriguingly, one of the condoms revealed a mixture of DNA, but it was only compared with the known suspects' genetic profiles. In a pivotal revelation, only Parsons' DNA matched the sample, raising the unsettling possibility of another individual's involvement in Hannah's brutal rape and murder. Potentially the other man identified by Minnie October, who had eluded arrest by the detectives. The DNA of Van Niekerk and Julius did not feature in any of the DNA profiles recovered from the condoms found at the crime scene. The meticulous gathering of evidence extended to both the interior and exterior of Hannah's car. Here, Parsons' fingerprint surfaced on the car's trunk, and his DNA was detected on the handle of a knife. Whipboy's DNA was discovered on a bottle of drink found inside the car. Following the presentation of the forensic evidence, Van Niekerk took the stand, vehemently professing his innocence. In a perplexed tone, he questioned the reason behind his arrest, declaring, "I didn't understand why I was arrested." However, a startling revelation emerged. Following his arrest, Van Niekerk had composed a letter of apology addressed to Hannah's grieving family. The letter conveyed, "I'm sorry for what I've done. I wish you can forgive me for what I've done." On the witness stand, he claimed that the detectives had requested him to write this letter, emphasizing that he had received only an elementary education up to grade 5. While Van Niekerk admitted his presence during the hijacking and robbery, he adamantly denied he had any involvement in the rape and murder of Hannah. As Van Niekerk stepped down from the witness stand, it was Parsons' turn to provide his testimony. He admitted to the hijacking of the car and kidnapping of Hannah and Cheslin. Yet he placed the blame squarely on Whipboy for the violence that unfolded. Parsons explained, "My intention was just to rob and hijack the car. I wanted to drop them off out of the town centre and take the car with me. My attention was on the road and to keep a watch on police." In a shocking revelation, Parsons claimed that Whipboy had told him that Hannah had consented to sexual activity with them, provided they didn't harm her. Parsons stated, "I watched her. I saw it in her eyes. She was terrified. But she said we could do it. I know it's not because she wanted to do it." Tears welled in his eyes as he expressed his reluctance to commit rape, citing his girlfriend and young children as reasons to refrain. Nevertheless, he confessed to his actions, asserting that he, Whipboy, and Van Niekerk had all raped Hannah. Parsons further revealed that he had tried to persuade the others to release Hannah after the assault, but they forcibly placed her in the car's trunk and drove to Norhurk Road. Parsons claimed, "She didn't want to climb out of the boot. She was holding on to the car. Van Niekerk came up and stabbed her. I let her go as the blood started to spill." The horrific narrative continued as Parsons stated that the other defendants had removed Hannah from the trunk, leaving him on the ground. He claimed to have witnessed Whipboy arriving with a rock, where he pleaded with him not to kill Hannah, but instead Whipboy hurled the rock at her head. Under cross-examinations, Parsons admitted his guilt for all 10 charges against him and explained his initial reluctance to plead guilty by confessing, "I was afraid the other accused were going to pin everything on me." The prosecutor pressed further, revealing that after abducting Hannah and Cheslin, Parsons had taken them to Jamestown, where he exposed Cheslin to another member of the 28s gang. The prosecutor asked, "You did this as you thought this person was your prey?" To this, Parsons replied, "That's correct." When questioned about the 28s gang, Parsons dismissed its significance outside of prison. Following Parsons' testimony, the trial was completed and it was time for closing arguments. The prosecutor didn't mince his words, accusing the defendants of attempting to confound the court by downplaying their roles in the heinous crimes. He contended that all 4 men had conspired to rob and abduct Hannah and Cheslin. With conviction, he stated, "At the robbery, the intention was to put the people in the boot. They weren't just going to get the car. They would take the people too. The agreement was to rob and kidnap. We know accused, too, had a knife." Julius's defense attorney asserted that he had departed from the scene before Hannah and Cheslin were abducted. He argued that if found guilty, it should only be on the charge of robbery, and not robbery with aggravating circumstances as he was unarmed. With closing arguments completed, Judge Rasheni Ali initiated her deliberations. She summoned everyone back to the courtroom on November 7th to deliver her verdict. The atmosphere that day was charged with emotion, as the courtroom was filled with the loved ones of Hannah and Cheslin, many donning t-shirts with Hannah's face on the front. Judge Ali then rendered her verdict.
"It is ordered that one, on count one, the robbery with aggravating circumstances of Cheslin Claude Marsh, accused 1, 2, 3, and 4 are guilty. On count 2, the robbery with aggravating circumstances of Hannah Cornelius, accused 1, 2, 3, and 4 are guilty. On count 3, the kidnapping of Cheslin Claude Marsh, accused 1, 2, 3, and 4 are guilty. On count 4, the kidnapping of Hannah Cornelius, accused 1, 2, 3, and 4 are guilty. This girl does a fee concert. On count 5, the attempted murder of Cheslin Claude Marsh, accused 1, 2, and 3 are guilty. On count 6, the murder of Hannah Cornelius, accused 1, 2, and 3 are guilty. On count 7, the rape of Hannah Cornelius, accused 1, 2, and 3 are guilty. Count 8, the robbery with aggravated circumstances of Nkomisa Gwikwina, accused 1, 2, and 3 are guilty. On count 9, the robbery with aggravated circumstances of Mimi October, accused 1, 2, and 3 are guilty. On count 10, the kidnapping of Mimi October, accused 1, 2, and 3 are guilty."
She found Vernon Whipboy, Geraldo Parsons, and Eben Van Niekerk guilty on all 10 charges. Nashville Julius was found guilty on 2 charges of robbery with aggravating circumstances and 2 charges of kidnapping. As the verdicts were announced, Parsons began to grin, while Whip Boy offered a thumbs up. The following day marked the sentencing phase of the trial. The prosecution sought the harshest penalty, and they called several witnesses to testify, including Hannah's father, William. His face was etched with grief as he lamented, "It is my belief that our family died with Hannah and was buried when my wife walked into the ocean a short time later and did not come back." He revealed how his wife, Anna, had become a mere shadow of her former self in the aftermath of her daughter's murder.
"My wife, in addition to being my best friend, was the strongest and most competent person I've ever met. She became a shadow of herself, inconsolable, frantic, almost manic in everything she did. Outwardly still in control, but inside she had very little to give. There was very little substance. She turned her back on a successful law practice and ploughed every bit of energy she had into the foundation with absolutely no regard for her health or any other practical considerations. No one really knows what happened on that early morning when she decided to go swimming in an ice-cold and stormy Atlantic Ocean. For myself, I do not believe that she committed suicide or she ended herself. But what I do believe is that she did not have the physical or mental strength left to counter any difficulties that she may have experienced."
William expressed his apologies for not attending the trial, explaining that he couldn't bear to hear the details of Hannah's ordeal. Tragically, just months after Hannah was killed, William was diagnosed with cancer, compounding his agony. He had lost his daughter, then his wife, and now he battled cancer himself. He had been discharged from work and relied on antidepressants, devoid of joy, hope, or aspirations for the future. Tearfully, he stated, "My son and I are not a family. We are the victims living in the ruins of what once existed."
"My son, Andries, does not understand the concept of death. Every night when I put him to bed, he stops in front of a framed photograph of Hannah and asks, 'When our day is over? When is she coming home? Hannah moet nou huis toe kom, haar vakansie is nou klaar.' This has now been going on every night for a year and a half."
He said that not a day passed without Andries inquiring about his mother.
"Still, I did not come here today to elicit sympathy, and I can't help feeling guilty about the publicity that this trial has gathered when the most vulnerable members of our society, the women, the children, the elderly, are seemingly assaulted, murdered and abused on a daily basis, and not an iota of the attention is paid to the majority of those cases. I do not know why. All that I know is that my daughter would have agreed that it is not fair."
Jeslyn's mother Marilyn also delivered a statement addressing the four defendants and emphasising that her son had done nothing to deserve the horrors that were inflicted upon him. The defence teams for the four men pleaded for leniency, citing their youthfulness, pressure to join gangs and lack of education as mitigating factors. Ultimately, the sentences were handed down. Whipboy and Parsons received 115 years each, along with two life sentences. Van Niekerk received 128 years with two life sentences. And Julius was sentenced to 22 years in prison. The courtroom erupted into jubilation upon hearing the sentences, prompting the marshals to call for silence. Judge Alley, in delivering the sentences, remarked that she was unconvinced of any genuine remorse from the four men, describing their actions as brutal and callous. She solemnly stated, "There is no doubt that the accused were lucid and consistent in their modus operandi. This was a harrowing experience for Cornelius to be assaulted this way. They could see the fear in her eyes and took full advantage to gangbang her for their own selfish sexual pleasure." In February of 2019, the Hannah Cornelius Centre became a reality in Ocean View, fulfilling a cherished dream of Anna's. She would have been overjoyed to witness the establishment. Tony Raphael reflected on this achievement, stating, "She wanted something positive to come from Hannah's death and live to open this centre. There is no doubt she would have cried tears of joy." William, Anna's husband, graced the occasion by cutting the ribbon, his face radiating with happiness. the centre played a vital role in the community, offering counselling and support programmes to the residents of Ocean View. During the same year, Cheslin embarked on his journey back to university, opting for the University of the Western Cape, instead of returning to Stellenbosch to study law. He explained, "I couldn't go back to Stellenbosch. I wanted it to be another place so I could move on after what had happened." The community rallied around Cheslin, providing immense support, scholarships and donations to assist with his educational expenses. In a touching gesture of recognition for his bravery, Cheslin was awarded a bursary from the Riva Rebecca Steenkamp Foundation the same year. However, November brought the closure of the Hannah Cornelius Foundation, a decision that was influenced by William's battle with terminal cancer, which left him unable to continue as the foundation's director. The directors expressed their gratitude to all the supporters who had stood by them throughout the years, directing future donations to valley development projects and community cohesion, entities providing essential services to the Ocean Views community from the Hannah Cornelius Centre. Tragically, just 1 week later, on December 9th, William passed away at home, surrounded by his family. In a heartfelt statement, the family shared, "Yesterday, Friday, we said goodbye to our gentle giant, an extraordinary giant. Our flag is up for you, our beloved William. We will cherish your memories until we can join you." Hannah Cornelius had an immense sense of responsibility towards the less fortunate, a trait ingrained in her by her family, who consistently emphasised the importance of their privilege. Her kindness and compassion were second nature to her. So when her friend Cheslin Marsh mentioned walking home alone at night, Hannah's immediate response was to arrange a ride for him. Little did they know that this act of kindness would lead them into an unfortunate encounter with four ruthless men in the midst of a crime spree, placing them at the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Emma. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally thankful. Please feel free to check it out if you want bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. Ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card and some cool merch. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support a show that you like, especially an independent show, and I really appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.